trends for your home and garden combined with a twist of the past. Everyone, it is March, and I sit here thinking, where did February go? But we have a great show lined up for you guys today on the Nest in Style podcast. We are going to be listening to Nan Sturman, who I'm a big fan of. I don't know if anybody in the California area has had a chance to see her speak at any of the garden show, but I think she's absolutely wonderful. She's going to talk to us, to you guys actually, about how to start from seed. And then Chris McLaughlin is also going to talk to us about the differences of heirlooms and hybrid seeds and get a little, talk a little bit about some interesting stories that she and Teresa are going to share. And then a great honor to have a special guest, Rebecca Sweet, who is a landscape designer from the California region. She's going to talk to us about some helpful tips for homeowners to consider when they think about redoing their backyard. How does that sound, Teresa?
Sounds like a killer show, I tell you, Jamie. And we should mention that, you know, Rebecca Sweet is the location of the upcoming Tweet Up for the San Francisco Garden Show. So all you lucky folks who are going to be going to the San Francisco Garden Show, you've just got to go to the Tweet Up at Rebecca Sweet's house, because her garden has been featured in Fine Gardening and her clients have been featured in Fine Gardening. So she's really quite a very talented designer and a very nice person as well.
Yes, I was really excited when you had told me that you had the opportunity to interview Rebecca Sweet. So that was fantastic. You know, I'm just going to pull a Robin Williams here quickly, Teresa. I have to address the iTunes issue because I've had a number of questions about it. So before we get onto our show, yes, many of you have noticed we're not on iTunes yet, and I do apologize, and we're making every effort to get that up there. So just be aware, you know, I don't know about you, Teresa, but if you've ever looked for a podcast on iTunes that only has one podcast, it's just really kind of not impressive at all. So, you know, once we're on iTunes, hopefully we're going to have 20 podcasts under our belts. Well, really, hopefully.
Well, hopefully not 20 shows, exactly. Maybe just one more, actually. You just never know. We like to keep you guys guessing.
That's exactly right.
We're collecting all these episodes, so you'll be able to just look at them all on iTunes in a very short time, we hope. I think it's great we're talking about seeds today, Jamie, because to me, there's such a wonderful aspect of seeds. This is such a time of new beginnings, and the fact that life can be created from such a small seed, and particularly when you look at the seeds of carrots, for example, they're so tiny. And yet, depending on what you're growing, and if it comes from this type of seed, then you can really grow a plant that you can either eat or smell or enjoy its beauty or find shelter under it or even receive medicinal help, because plants provide us with so many different uses and purposes in our world, and much of it comes from a seed, folks. So
that's exactly right, and that's, I think, very, you know, a reason obviously we're in the seed season right now, but I think it's great to talk about these different experts in the seed industry, because I'm somewhat of a novice gardener in starting my garden from seed, so to speak. And I can't stress enough to those of you who haven't started from seed yet, you know, maybe you just bought some sprouts or seedlings at the nursery. There is a huge difference of the personal ownership you take of your garden once you start them from seed, like what Teresa's saying. So it's a huge eye-opener into a whole different world and aspect of gardening that, you know, just wait, folks, it's exciting.
It is. So I think it's great that you had a chance to talk to Nan Sturman, and I can't wait to hear the interview, Jamie.
I had a chance to talk with her in Seattle at the Northwest Flower and Garden Show, and I've seen Nan give this talk a couple of times. The first time last year in San Francisco, and now this past February in Seattle. And I thought it would be a great opportunity for her to share with other listeners who haven't quite gotten into starting their garden from seed. She is one of the best people I have heard break it down into steps that, you know, is interesting enough for you know, advanced gardeners as well as for beginning gardeners. So sit back and relax and make sure you have a pen and paper, because she gives tips that I haven't either read in a magazine or haven't heard from other people. So be sure to pay attention to this one. I am here at the Northwest Flower and Garden Show in Seattle, Washington, and I'm here sitting with Nan Sturman, who I am a big fan with, and I met her last year at the San Francisco Flower and Garden Show. Wonderful speaker. We're going to sit here and we're going to talk to her today about seed starting. It's a topic that if you're new to gardening, or even if you're not new to gardening, but you're new to starting your garden from seed, it can be somewhat of an overwhelming task. But Nan does a great job at breaking it down, providing you the confidence, and, you know, basically get over that hump of just do it, okay? You're going to fail. It's okay. Just try it again. So, Nan, if you wouldn't mind just going real quickly some of your successful tips of seed propagation and plant propagation.
Okay, well, that could take me 2 hours, but I won't do that. Some of the successful tips. Well, one thing, make sure you start with sterilized pots and labels, because one of the things that kills seedlings most often is fungus, things you can't see, little bacteria, little fungus in the soil and in the air that lands on the soil and attacks the plants. So you want to take the pots you're going to use, whatever you use for a pot. You could use a yogurt container. You can use takeout dishes. You can use pots that have been used for something else. Soak them in a mixture of 10% bleach and 90% water. So 9%, nine parts water, one part bleach. Okay. And soak them for about an hour. You know, wash them off, get the grit off and stuff. It doesn't have to be perfectly clean, but clean them off as best you can. Soak them for about 20 minutes to an hour, anything around there, and then dry them. While you're at it, toss in your old plant labels. You know, you can reuse those plastic plant labels. You can either erase what's on or use the backside.
That's right. That's what you said. It's right? Blank on the back.
It's blank on the back. So toss them into the solution as well. Let them soak so they're all clean. And that you can, if you want, you can sterilize whatever bin you're going to mix your seed starting mix with, water, whatever. Just keep it as clean as you can. You don't have to be in a laboratory, but try to keep it as clean as you can. That's a really good place to start.
Yeah, and what about the soil mix?
Soil mix, really important. This isn't a time to use dirt from the backyard, and it's not time to use your wonderful homemade compost. Go, because that's not what these seedlings need. What they need is what they call a sterile seed starting mix. It's not really sterile, but it's very, very finely milled so that this little stems and roots and whatever have a really easy time pushing through the soil. And not only is it finely milled, but it's pasteurized. So a lot of those nasty fungi and bacteria and things that would attack it are killed in the process. So again, you're starting with fresh, clean seed mix, and you're starting with clean pots. And as long as you wash your hands, you're pretty much along the way.
I mean, it just kind of, it makes sense. I mean, a lot of having this success in a garden in the beds outside is having proper soil and, you know, making the conditions right for the plant. It kind of, you know, this is what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Starting out right.
And when the seedlings are small, they don't have much, I guess you would say, in the way of immunity. You're kind of like a person, you know, a little baby. You're going to take much better care about washing your hands and, you know, taking care of them, making sure they don't get germs than you or me. You know, that's just what happens.
Yeah. And so in damping off is... Big problem. I know at least anybody who's tried to start anything from seed has had this issue. You brought up something, and it may be very common knowledge, but I had never heard it before.
Yeah,
what's your secret?
Okay, well, let's talk about what damping off is first, okay?
Yes.
All right, so you start your seeds, and they sprout. And you see these little green things. You go, oh, it worked, right? And they start elongating. They get 3 inches tall, 2 inches tall, 4 inches tall, whatever it is. And then one day, you go outside, and the stem looks like it was folded in half. I mean, it just flopped over. And there's nothing around. It wasn't a bug. You don't know what it is. It's just, boom, it's gone. And it's really frustrating. That's what we call damping off.
And once it does that...
It's gone. You have to start over again.
Yeah.
So the reason that happens is that there's a fungus that either comes in the soil or it's in the air. I don't exactly know where it comes from. But when you have that wet soil surface, the fungus proliferates. The numbers start increasing, and their favorite food is seedlings. And that's what's happened. This is one of the reasons we want things to be clean to start with. But this stuff is ubiquitous. You can't avoid it. So the thing you do is after you put your seeds in the seedling mix, in the seed starting mix, and you cover them up however deep you need to, depending on the size of the seed. You give the you top it off with a thin layer of either very fine gravel, they call gravel grit. I think it's number one gravel, maybe a different number, but it's really, really tiny. They also feed it to chickens. Don't ask me. I guess to help them digest their food. Right. There's some gravel grit that comes with the oyster shells. You don't want that because it's got all kinds
no
of
calcium. Oyster shells.
No, just the gravel grit. Little tiny gravel. It's about the size of aquarium gravel. You know, the stuff you put on the bottom of granite. Not the granite grit is granite, so it's not light.
Okay.
You can use that. You can use construction sand, not playground sand, but a construction sand, which is also really finely ground rock. Or you can use perlite, that white kind of like styrofoamy stuff.
Right, where people mostly are used to putting it and mixing it in soil.
Right, exactly. So you're just going to top
it on top.
Yeah, so you just want maybe a quarter inch layer of one of those three on top to cover all the soil. What happens then is that if those fungal spores land on the surface, they're landing on something that's totally inert and cannot support them. It's dry, it has no organic material in it, so they can't get any nutrition from it, and they just won't develop. So that takes care of 90% of making the number up. It just improves your success rate hugely. If you still get damping off, what you can do is, and chances are, very small, but you might, what you can do is grab that bottle of powdered cinnamon out of the kitchen cabinet, sprinkle it over the surface of the pot or the container where you started your seeds, just like powdered sugar, like you're sprinkling powdered sugar, and that is an antifungal, and it'll help protect your seedlings from the damping off.
As well as smell nice.
Yes, it smells lovely.
Ooh, wonderful. Yes. I like that idea.
Yeah.
That is such a wonderful best practice tip. Other than damping off, though, Nan, is there any other downside to starting seeds in your home that people should be aware of?
Downside. The downside would be that if you get really overly enthusiastic, you may end up with 100 more plants than you have room for, and then you got to figure out what to do with them. I can't think of much. I mean, there's in terms of dangers. Well, there's always the danger. I mean, if you decide to transplant your plants and you grab them by the stem and squeeze a little hard, you can damage the stem and then the plant's gone. As I said this morning in my talk,
that's right.
Plants
grab
only have
leaves.
One grab the leaves because plants have one stem, but they have lots of leaves. And if you happen to tear a leaf, no big deal. But if you destroy the stem, it's a goner.
Yep. Start over.
So you just have to be careful about how you're handling things.
And you bring up another issue that's really tough for people who like to grow from seeds, is killing the little seedlings.
Oh, no. Planticide.
Planticide, that's what you call it.
Planticide. Okay. We always start more seeds than we ultimately need because you want to maximize the possibility that you're going to end up with the plants you want. So if I need 6 plants, I'm going to start 20 seeds. Okay? Just so I start many more because I know I'm going to lose some. So in a container, like if I'm using a recycled 6-pack, okay, and I'm putting seeds into each of the individual cells, there's 6 cells in a 6-pack, okay,
right.
Cleaned it off, got my seed mix wet, put the seed mix in the little seed potting soil, put my seeds in, I'm putting 3 seeds in each cell, laying them out like a triangle, because I don't want them right stacked on top of each other.
Right, so then they're like...
That won't work. It'll just be a mess.
Yeah.
So I'm going to look at the area and visually decide where the two corners are and where the fulcrum point. So we have three points. I'm going to put in 3 seeds, cover them with soil, whatever. And let's assume all 3 sprout.
Okay.
Congratulations. 3 of them sprouted. In every cell, you've got 18 little plants, but
you're so excited.
Right. But you only want 1 per cell.
Right.
Right. So what you do is when the little seedlings develop the first set of leaves are what they call the seed leaves. Those are not true leaves.
Okay.
The second set of leaves are the true leaves, and they look like the leaves that the plant will ultimately have. So when they have either their second set or their second and their third set, so that's usually, the seedling's a couple inches tall, you have to decide which of the 3 seedlings in each cell is the strongest and kill the others.
It's like trying to pick... saying that you have a favorite child over
another. It's not.
Okay. No, you're giving us permission.
Yes, you have permission to kill your plants. Not in all situations. Well, actually, you do. I think trial and error is a wonderful thing. But yeah. So what you want to do is when it's time to, this is thinning. Essentially, this is thinning.
Okay.
All right? If you were doing the ground, you'd spread your seeds out and you'd thin eventually anyway. So you're thinning. But instead of pulling out the unwanted seedlings, if you do that, you're going to potentially disrupt the roots of the one you want to keep. That's not good. So I suggest you get one of those little fingernail scissors, the baby fingernail scissors.
Yes.
They have little rounded edges instead of sharp edges. And you just carefully snip each the two unwanted ones out of each cell using that little scissors. If it's like lettuce or greens, just pop it in your mouth.
There you go.
Why wouldn't you? It's
yeah.
It's just a sprout. It's sprouted seeds. Right?
And sprouts are good.
Sprouts are good. It's microgreens.
Yeah, that's the correct term. It's microgreens.
Microgreens, yes. You pay a lot of that for that in the restaurant.
At the store, you will. You will pay a lot for that.
Yeah. So that's planticide. And that's okay. Yeah. That's legal planticide.
Legal planticide. I was watching the people in the audience when you were talking about that, and that was hard.
Yeah, it's always hard.
But,
it's the hardest thing to do. But you know what? If you don't do it, those three little seedlings will all suffer. So you're putting two out of their misery, and the third one will then thrive.
There. That makes sense.
Okay.
Makes a lot of sense.
Okay.
So you were also talking today about, somebody was asking you about the Jiffy Peep Pucks or whatever those things are called.
Yeah.
I liked what you said, because the less I have to, like, transplant, you know, because not everything transplants very well, right? You said put it in a container in a size that... Will you explain it?
Okay, well, it did. Those are two different things.
Okay.
Someone asked me if I like the fiber pots, like the Jiffy pots.
Okay.
And I don't generally use those because, I mean, the idea is that the pots themselves biodegrade, and so you can plant directly into the soil. And I don't use those because I find when I do use them, that fiber is so porous. Not porous. All the water wicks out. It just totally dries out. It's really hard to keep your little plants, your little seedlings wet enough. The soil dries out, et cetera. And when you plant them in the ground, you've always got the little rim above the soil, and the water wicks out there too. So they don't work all that well.
Okay.
Unless you're going to tear them off, and you don't want to go there. So, and a lot of people... Okay, so that's one thing. Those are the fiber pots.
Okay.
The other thing is, a lot of people will take a very small container and put all the seeds from one envelope into that container, start them all real close together, and then tweeze them apart and transplant them to a small pot, and then move them up to a bigger pot, move them up to a bigger pot. And it's that transition, going from the little tiny seedling into the small pot, and then taking out of that and putting the bigger pot, et cetera, that's where I fail. Okay, that's where I have my greatest frustration and where I almost gave up starting the seed, because I just couldn't keep them alive from step one to step two.
Right.
Okay? So that's why I like using those recycled six-packs or four-packs, the ones with the bigger cells, or a yogurt container, like a little yogurt container, poke holes in the bottom, and just start, like, if you're going to do tomatoes, three seeds in one of those, or if you're going to do, like, cucumbers, one seed, because those have enough volume of soil to support the seedling until it's big enough to literally put into the ground.
Bingo.
You don't have to move them into different pots. You just want to grow it in that amount of soil. They'll grow big enough to be able to transplant outside.
Brilliant. Just brilliant, Ms. Nan Sturman.
Or lazy.
Hey, you know,
or just busy.
That's busy people. I know, that's like today's gardener.
Yeah, absolutely. We're all busy, and the more tips, the more things you can learn to be really good at doing it efficiently. I mean, that's really the goal, is doing it efficiently and well.
Yeah. Now, you gave us some seed packets of Renee seeds.
Yeah.
And before I had met you in San Francisco, I had actually never heard of Renee seeds. Up here in this area, Territorial Seed Company is big.
Yes. And they have great seeds too.
And they do have great seeds. But when I saw the Renee seed packet, and you pointed out all the benefits of that packet, I thought, this is an awesome packet.
It has
so much information.
Yep.
Can you just give some highlights? I don't have one with me, but...
That's okay. Renee Shepherd, who is Renee Shepherd of Renee's Garden Seeds, has been doing this for a long time now. I mean, she is really, really good, and she's really smart. And so Renee decided that, at some point, that she wanted to give her customers the greatest possibility of being successful. I mean, from a marketing standpoint, it's brilliant.
Yep.
But she's also a former professor. So she understands about education and about teaching people and giving the information they need to be successful. So Renee's packets are like little books, each one in and of itself. if you turn it on the side, I'm trying to remember, on the side, she lists the months that each type of seed needs to be started, because you can't start all kinds of seeds. They won't start all types at all different times in the year.
Right.
Some are winter, some are spring, some are fall, etc. So time of year to start, how long you should expect it to take for the seed to germinate, that's to sprout. So if it says germination 5 to 7 days and it's been 2 weeks and nothing's happened, start again. Something's wrong.
Yeah.
Okay? If you're going to be going out of town for 2 weeks and it takes 5 days to germinate, maybe wait till you come back. Right?
Okay, I've actually done that.
Yeah, well, we all have. You get so excited about starting that you just want to do it.
I know. And oh, darn it.
Yeah, so. Right. And they came up and they died.
Yeah.
So you don't want to do that. She also tells you how close together to plant the seeds. Mm-hmm. And then she tells you how long to expect until you can harvest whatever, if it's lettuce, until you can start picking leaves, or if it's tomatoes, when you can start picking fruit, etc. And the point I made earlier today was that when you look at those numbers for days to harvest, it's not an absolute. It's the number of days in Renee's experience where she gardens.
And she's in where in California?
She's in Santa Cruz.
In Santa Cruz, okay.
And it could be that she, you know, talks to lots of people in different places, but the point is, this is a big world, and, you know, there are so many climates and microclimates that it's never going to be exact. It's not an exact science.
Right.
However, if you have three different seed packets, and one says it's your time, harvest in 80 days, one says harvest in 95 days, and one says harvest in 120 days, you know that the 80 days is an early season, and the 95 days is mid-season, and the 120 days is late season. So if you plant tomatoes from each of those packets, if you start seeds from each of those packets, you'll have a very, very long harvest, because first the early season producers are going to ripen, and then the mid-season producers, and then the late season producers. So it really helps to have an idea of just, relative what the ripening sequence is.
Right, and this is kind of a... I don't know if it happens to all new gardeners, but I thought, okay, Territorial is the only seed packet I can grow from because it's grown right in the Willamette Valley, so that's the only seed type I can grow. But you made a good point today. Renee's seeds may be true to Renee's area, but that doesn't mean you can't grow them up here in the North Midwest.
No, no.
It might just take longer.
Okay, no, there's a point here that you're missing.
Oh,
okay.
Tell me.
Where does Territorial grow their seeds?
In the Willamette Valley.
Are you sure? They harvest all their seeds in the Willamette Valley?
No.
Seeds come from all over the world. Okay?
Yes.
There are growers of different kinds of seeds all over the world. And they may have some seed that come from the Willamette Valley, but I'd be very surprised if all of their seed comes from the Willamette Valley. It comes from all over the place. But
that's right.
Their job is to select varieties that they think are going to be most successful. And Territory, as I recall, doesn't specify that they're for a particular region, right?
No, they don't.
No, and they sell all over the country.
That's right.
So it's a common misconception. I mean, yes, we all want to buy local. There's no question about it. You want
right.
to support your local people? Yes, absolutely. But it doesn't necessarily follow that because they're in the Willamette Valley that their seeds are the best seeds for the Willamette Valley. It would be a good thing to ask the guys at Territory. How do they select their seeds, and how do they determine where the seeds come from, just in general terms, and how do they decide which seeds they're going to offer each year?
Thank you for clearing that up.
Sure.
Because if I had that question, I'm sure other people have that question.
Absolutely.
And last question for you.
Yeah.
You're a champ, because I know you've had a busy show,
yeah,
and I really appreciate it.
Three talks in 24
I know,
hours.
And
yeah.
This, folks, you don't know it, but I'm keeping Nan here at 6 o'clock in the evening, talking to us about seeds
it's
that she's talked
pleasure.
About all day long.
It's okay. It's my pleasure. Don't worry about it, Jamie. I'm happy to do it.
But one last question.
Go ahead.
What's the difference between a 50-cent seed pack and Renee's seeds that may cost like $3.25 for a pack?
Oh, how long do you have? Okay.
Okay.
It's like anything else in life. Well, a lot of things in life. You get what you pay for. Okay. A 50-cent seed pack, what quality are those seeds? What quality are the seeds that whoever is selling them can afford to sell for 50 cents? What's the viability? Viability means when you plant them, what's the rate what's the germination rate? If you plant 10 seeds, how many are going to come up? Or how many are going to be old and never come up? You know, seeds have a shelf life. It's longer than you think. It's not just 1 year. It depends on how you store them. You got to store them somewhere cool and dry, usually, in order to keep them from year to year. But they have a shelf life. And a lot of times, for example, people who package those really cheap seeds, they buy the old seed from, you know, leftover from 3 or 4 or 5, 10 years ago.
Oh, interesting.
Okay.
Yeah.
Or they don't have very good quality control. Renee and Territory and the good companies have very good quality control. And they will tell you that they test their seeds rigorously. And that's what you're getting. You're getting excellent selection because they are very careful about the seeds they choose, the varieties they choose. They're doing incredible quality control. And, you know, it's a very small amount to pay for that kind of quality.
So if I, because I'm always like, okay, let's do an analogy here. So the 50 cent, both packets have 10 seeds. 50 cent germination might be 2 seeds out of 10 will germinate.
Yeah.
But then Renee's maybe 9 out of 10 will germinate.
That's or kind 10 of, out of 10.
10 out of
okay,
10.
Okay, we're just doing hypothetical numbers
hypothetical.
Here. But yes, that's, yes. I mean, that's what you can expect. And the vigor of the plants once they sprout.
Good point.
You know, are they going to be strong plants or weak plants? Are they going to make it? Are they going to produce? Or are they going to just kind of sit there and look at you and say, I don't think so, and curl up and die?
Yeah.
So there's a ton of testing that goes in. There's a ton of quality issues, just like there is in any industry. And, you know, there's no reason to spend $10 on a packet of seeds. That's kind of expensive.
Yeah.
But when you can spend $3 and get 30, 40, 50, 100 seeds, that's a bargain. That's
just
a bargain.
I know. Well, just think about how much money you spend at a grocery store buying those same edibles that you could be growing.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Oh, yeah. And you know what? There's more seeds in a packet than you will use in a year, no matter what.
Yeah. I don't have a garden that big.
Yeah. And a lot of people are doing containers. You know, how many tomatoes can you fit in your garden?
A lot.
Like?
Like 10? 7, 10.
That's a lot?
Well, here's the thing. I can't eat that many, so I don't grow that many. But I'm sure...
Well, that's a whole other discussion. We'll have that discussion at some other point.
Okay.
But if, you know, if you get a packet of 50 seeds and all you need is 7 plants, right?
Yeah.
That's pretty damn good because it means you can use it this year and start your 7, and next year you can start 7, and how many? 7 times you can start that. 7 times 7?
7 times 7.
49.
Yeah. Yep.
Not bad.
Ooh. That's not bad for 6 o'clock.
I was going to say, for adult brains.
Man, thank you so much for breaking this down for those of us who just need that little extra confidence and a little extra know-how in starting our own seeds.
Okay, so can I tell you this? I have a video on starting seeds.
Tell us.
Okay, if you go to my website, which is plantsoup.com, www.plantsoup.com, and you go to the TV tab, TV radio tab at the top, it will take you to a page that lists, oh, I don't know, 7, 8, 10 video clips, and one of them is starting seeds.
We're going to have that link for you folks on our podcast page. So,
cool.
Yeah.
Cool.
Nan makes starting seeds easy. I'm going to make it easy for you to find Stan. Nan.
Stan. That's
Stan.
My name. Stan.
Nan, Stan, you know.
Whatever it is. It's 6 o'clock.
It is 6 o'clock. You know, it's time for a beer or something.
Wow, that was really a great interview, Jamie, and I particularly found it interesting what Nan and you both discussed on the type of information that can be found on seed packages. And I tend to order from a lot of different companies for different reasons. And the seeds that I tend to prefer the most or that are helpful for me often do have that type of information, such as how deep to plant the seed, how large the plant is going to grow, how long it will take for the seed to germinate in the first place, whether it needs full sun or partial shade. And these types of gardening information are very valuable, and I think that's great. And I also wanted to mention to our listeners that I find seed catalogs extremely fun to read. And there's a lot of great historical information and planting advice that you can find in various seed catalogs as well. Don't you think, Jamie?
Absolutely. Colorful pictures in the history behind each seed is really something that I'm starting to get into. And, you know, Nan talked about, I had noticed that Nan talks about Renee's seeds. And so I asked her, you know, why do you talk about Renee's gardens? Garden seeds so much, and for that reason, all the information packed on a little tiny seed catalog, which is really super helpful for a beginning seed gardener like myself.
Oh, you mean a seed package?
I'm sorry, a seed packet. Thank you. I did contact Renee's Seeds, Renee's Gardens, and unfortunately, I wasn't able to sell their seeds. You know, they have their own online catalog, or catalog, which is great. So I decided to choose another company, which is Botanical Interest, and they are strongly rooted upon education of all different types of gardeners, which I totally appreciate, because that's in a sense what we try to accomplish here with Nest and Style. It's not just about, you know, us, you know, Teresa and I talking about what plants we grow, but we want to offer education that you can use in your own backyard. And Botanical Interest Seed Packet, and we'll have a little link to this, you guys will notice it is chock full of information. On the back, on the inside, it talks about the history of seeds, recipes you can use, and when to plant outside, all of it. All the necessary information you need to know to become a successful seed gardener.
That's great. And also, for example, other seed companies such as RareSeeds.com will have very great historical information and very helpful photos. And if you read Seed Savers Exchange catalog, there's a lot of very helpful historical information and planting and growing information. But I agree with you that many seed providers could do a better job of providing this type of planting information for beginners. And it's great that you're able to provide a seed that does provide that information. And we do want to mention, folks, that there will be links to a number of seed companies on the podcast page. So with no further ado, what I think is really interesting is this party that you're having coming up.
I know. I'm really excited. It's actually tonight.
Tonight. Wow.
It is. It's tonight. I know. So I'm just taking a little quick.
And she's so calm, folks. Do you notice?
Say that again?
You're so calm. You're so calm.
Yeah, well, I really start gearing up and saving everything for last, you know, like the last 2 hours before the party. But no, it's an idea that I actually originally saw in Sunset Magazine. I think Associate Editor Julie Chai mentioned it when she was talking about the different seeds, that seed companies that we're talking about on this podcast. And I thought that is a great idea. You know, one of the reasons why I thought having a seed party was a good idea is because not only do some people not have enough space to grow every little seed that comes in those packets, but maybe you don't want 4 20-foot rows of beets, you know.
Right.
So this is a time to just drink local beer and wine, serve appetizers that you can grow or that you can make from the ingredients you grow in your backyard, as well as get together with your friends and say, hey, I'm thinking about growing beets and broccoli. Do you want to go in and share the seeds? Because not everybody's great about storing the seeds in each packet year after year, you know.
Right. And so, they don't always last forever.
Exactly.
Oftentimes on the seed package, they'll tell you how long the seed is viable for, approximately how many years. But that's a great idea, Jamie, because in many ways it reminds me of an old-fashioned seed swap too, where people can get together and share seeds or share seeds that they have themselves with other people.
That's right.
So If you don't happen to have an innovative retailer, online retailer doing something like this in your neighborhood, folks, look also at some of those seed exchanges too, because that's a great way to get the kind of quantity of seeds that you need, and it also allows you to buy seeds in larger quantities to share.
Fern from Life on the Balcony has started a nice little seed swap.
So that's great.
I'll include that link on the podcast page as well for people who already have seeds.
Well, we wish you lots of luck on your party.
Well, thank
and
you.
thanks for talking to us when you're so calm.
Yeah, we'll
such
see.
A busy
we'll see
day.
How it goes later tonight.
And I think one of the coolest things that impressed me the most about seeds is that it gives you this large variety of vegetables that you might not automatically have. And particularly if you're interested in heirloom seeds, you can find a greater variety than you can even imagine. So that's why we're just delighted to get a chance to speak with Chris McLaughlin, who is going to speak with us about hybrids and heirlooms, Jamie. And she's actually writing a book called The Complete Idiot's Guide to Heirlooms, which is coming out later this year.
Excellent.
So not that we have any idiots among our listeners, but she can help shine the light on this confusing topic a little more for us.
That's great.
Well, let's get going. Going many grocery stores today, and it's easy to believe that fruit and vegetables look a certain way, that tomatoes are always red and perfectly shaped, or that carrots are long and orange, or that eggplants are black and fat. But when you grow your own food, you'll see that there's a lot of different varieties of vegetables out there, and the tomatoes, carrots, eggplants, and all the rest of those vegetables and fruits come in all different colors and sizes and shapes, and often the strangest looking ones end up tasting the best. That's why we're so delighted today, because today I'm sitting with Chris McLaughlin, who is an expert on heirloom seeds. And as you'll find today, many of these heirloom seeds and varieties reveal a lot about our past and offer us a lot of great options in the garden that we may not have thought about. So, Chris, thank you very much for joining us today.
You're welcome. I'm so excited to be here. This is terrific.
And I should mention that Chris is the author of The Complete Idiot's Guide to Composting, which will be coming out in May 2010. And she is also the author of The Complete Idiot's Guide to Heirloom Vegetables, which will be coming out in December 2010. Well, why don't we start right off, Chris, and what is an heirloom? You know, there's a lot of different definitions out there. How do you define an heirloom?
Well, you know, there are a lot of different definitions. And I think that for me, I think that anything that has been brought down when you have an open pollinated variety, they would usually be created, say, five generations down, generations of the plant, not necessarily humans. And once they're established and they're very stable and they keep creating exactly the same as their parents, that is sort of a solid, you know, heirloom variety. A lot of the Puritans who are really, you know, passionate about what they do, they really prefer to think of them as plants that are 50 years old or more. Some of them really love hearing the rich stories behind them. And if they have a story, that makes them an heirloom, a family history. I really think that once an open pollinated variety is established, I really put that right in there because they are not hybrids at that point. They are, you know, themselves, and they create pure seed that will look exactly like their parents.
Right.
So I put them all together.
That's a very good point. So whether you think they have to be 50 years old or whatever, the most important point about an heirloom, folks, is that these are open pollinated plants with seeds that are going to reproduce true to type. And that's different from a hybrid, isn't it, Chris?
Yes, hybrids. Normally, why they started creating the hybrids is they would take something that they found, maybe a plant they wanted bigger tomatoes. Tomatoes seem to be the people's favorite. So if you take a tomato that perhaps was something that was a land race, and a land race was an open pollinated variety that grew well in a specific zone, and they took it somewhere else and they found that it wasn't growing as well. So they would take another plant, another tomato plant that was growing really well in the area, and they would cross those together, creating this hybrid variety. What ends up happening is the seed, you can eat those tomatoes, they come out fantastic, they might taste good or grow well or even fight disease, but the seed inside will not reproduce that parent plant. The tomato that you're eating, if you were to keep that seed and regrow it, you would not get that same tomato. You would get a throwback from something else. So it's a very unstable, what they call instability as far as growing, you know, these plants. And so, you know, you can't save your seed and regrow the same ones, which is, you know, kind of a problem. And in fact, some of these seed companies won't even tell you really what they used to create a wonderful hybrid variety, mm-hmm. because it's sort of their little patent trade secret.
Sure.
So anyway, you have to guess at that.
And so that's of course a disadvantage, that you can't save the seeds and have it reproduce exactly. But when you look at, for example, tomatoes, many of those hybrids that we have higher resistance to certain diseases. So many times hybrids may offer features that are attractive, like maybe they're a little smaller than the norm, or maybe they have better disease resistance. So wouldn't you agree, Chris, that there are also advantages to hybrids, even though the seed saving and being able to keep the same seeds for generations isn't possible.
I think definitely hybrids have their place. And the interesting thing about the hybrids is that they have made them very disease resistant and therefore easy to grow in certain areas, or I should say in a wider variety of areas. With some of the hybrids, when you do get something that has been grown, say in one area, say the San Francisco Bay Area, predominantly, that plant has evolved to defend itself against things. So that plant will grow well there. But then I send some to you, that the same seed, and it doesn't do well. Maybe verticillium wilt or something takes it over very easily. And the hybrid varieties, they can grow in all these different areas, and no matter where they are, tend to do well and defend themselves well against these things. So they're sometimes, I don't want to say easier to grow, but more widely adaptable in a lot of ways.
Interesting.
I mean, but it's a, you know, it's a give and take, and it's fun to have both, really.
And, you know, one of the best things I think about the heirlooms is that these heirlooms, as you mentioned, have a great deal of history, and they also offer a much larger variety of different foods than we see in our grocery store. And so I think that they really help in many ways to keep the diversity of our food heritage alive. And I'm sure in your research you've seen that as well, that the importance of protecting these old hybrids. I can give you a perfect example. I just ordered a number of seeds from my garden, and you know, as seasonal wisdom, I love all the historic aspects of plants. So, for example, some of the ones I'm growing are St. Valery carrots, which are from at least 1885, and they are a wonderful red-orange carrot that stores very well. And I just found a wonderful radish seed from rareseeds.com, which is called the Helios radish. And these are bright yellow olive-shaped radishes, which, believe it or not, Chris, they're from the Slovakian city very close to the village where my grandfather was from. So I said, I have to get these.
Oh, that's so cool.
So I think...
You have to.
Exactly. Yeah. So I think, haven't you found in your research that many of these, for example, how has our food diversity changed and disappeared over recent decades?
Well, you know, I don't know. I did some research on trying to find out just how long it took for these things to disappear. I didn't get a definitive number. But what I have learned from, you know, the professional plant breeders out there is that we've lost about 90% of our diversity already.
Wow.
That's gone.
Wow.
And it can't be brought back. But what's interesting to note about keeping some of this diversity, I think this is so kind of fascinating, it's a little bit tongue-in-cheek, is that when they go to take the hybrids, and let's say they're looking for some great thing, they're looking for a great flavor that they need to add to maybe a plant they already have that does well, or even something that is disease-resistant, because these plants do evolve to become resistant to certain things in certain areas, or maybe, you know, another pest. They actually take the genetic code from the heirlooms that they're actually sort of, you know, they're not touting the heirlooms, and yet they're taking their genetic code and putting them into the hybrid plants, and they're creating the hybrids from these heirlooms. So it's interesting how we do need to keep those heirlooms around. We need their genetic code. We need the diversity. And just like we saw with the Great Potato Famine, how literally they planted in Ireland all the same potato, exactly the same thing, and when a disease came along, it wiped out every last one. Nothing was spared.
That's a very good point.
So sad. Yeah, and sadly enough, 1 million people died from starvation.
Well, I think, as you said,
very interesting.
You know, the whole idea of having one variety and the fact that 90% of our food diversity has disappeared is major. And so I think oftentimes I would really encourage our listeners to grab a couple of these seed catalogs that specialize in the heirlooms and the rare seeds. And we can list a number of them on our podcast page for you to find. Because when you start to look at the histories behind these and you recognize the attributes of these different foods and the fact that you can keep the seeds and continue to grow these plants over and over and over again, as people have done for generations, it just seems a shame not to include some of them in your garden. Now, Chris, what are some of your favorite stories about? Could you give me one or two stories that you like about certain varieties?
Sure. Sure. One of them isn't as much of a story, but I do love how they arrived to our country, which is so fascinating. How, you know, they often did not want these seeds leaving the country or escaping customs and stuff. They didn't want to have to clear anything. And the women would sew the seeds in the hems of their dresses.
Wow.
In order to bring them here. And also, I also heard recently that they would also stick them inside stamps.
Ooh.
And mail letters to America. And then you'd be able to stamp off and find a seed and we could grow them here. But one of my favorite stories, I think, is of mortgage lifter. I think a lot of people have heard this story, but I just think it's fascinating. The mortgage lifter tomato, where a gentleman who was a radiator guy, he fixed radiators for a living, and he had, I think it was, oh, now I don't, of course, remember. I think it was a $6,000 mortgage on his home. My gosh, like I wish. And anyway, he was doing very badly. And it was during a time where the country was, you know, depressed. And he had to find a way to make a little extra money. And he did garden, but he was not a big plant person, per se.
Mm-hmm.
He just decided to build this tomato. So he started practicing with his tomato, and he eventually built, you know, created, built this very large, wonderful tomato. And it was just his, and they called it Radiator Charlie's. And he sold them, and people came from all over. They loved this tomato. They went crazy. And he was able to pay off his $6,000 mortgage with this tomato plant, this radiator guy built and sold on the side, and of course it became mortgage lifter.
Exactly, and it's very famous one too. Did you ever hear of the lazy housewife? This is the lazy housewife was the first completely stringless bean that was introduced around 1810, and you know, obviously it was a little discourteous to women everywhere, but it's one of the oldest documented beans, and it's very productive, and basically it was a very easy bean for women to collect. So if you were lazy, you didn't have to string them. You could pick them easily, and it produced a lot. There you go.
Isn't that great? And I don't know if you heard of that. This isn't actually a vegetable. It's a flower, but the outhouse hollyhock.
Oh.
I love this story. Do you know that one?
Isn't that where that, wouldn't that tell you where the outhouse was, the hollyhock?
Exactly. Back in the day, a woman did not want to walk into someone's home and say, I'm sorry, I need to use the bathroom. So they did not want to ask where that outhouse was. So, of course, to be courteous to women with their sensitivities, they would grow these hollyhocks out so the woman looked outside and knew exactly where they were. So these stories are fantastic.
Exactly.
Some of the great fun.
They are, and they really are. And the fact that they often offer different types of tastes. For example, I just am trying a new carrot. It's called Tanda de Parigis carrot, and it's a 19th century Parisian heirloom carrot that's 1 to 2 inches in size, and it's completely round or round in shape. So that was that's also known, I think it's French Market was another name. So it's, you know, these, once you start getting into heirlooms, folks, you will love it, whether you're growing the purple potted pole beans that are beautifully purple, or dragon's tongue, which is spotted. There's so many wonderful vegetables and fruits out there. Wouldn't you say, Chris?
Yeah, and with the carrot you mentioned, I'm actually growing those this year myself.
Which is ideal for different soil climates.
Yeah, exactly. And especially, you know, in a lot of areas, I know that I'm in Northern California, and maybe not every single microclimate clearly has the same, but we have a lot of clay. And a lot of people's soils are not real loamy yet, or, you know, maybe they don't have time to work on it, or, you know, hasn't gotten there. And they can absolutely grow these delicious carrots. And they're nice and round and ball-shaped, which is, you know, really exciting and different on the dinner table. And they're able to grow them and not worry about growing the long, tapered root ones and stuff. With these heirlooms, there's so much diversity, and the colors.
Oh, I love.
Brilliant.
And the taste. And also, you guys, those of you in the northern climates, look at those varieties carefully, because sometimes if you have trouble growing eggplants, for example, there may be a variety that is ripe from transplant in 50 to 60 days, which would be perfect for those of you in northern short growing climates. So
exactly.
There's something out there for everybody. Now, Chris, we really appreciate your time here. And I just wondered if there was anything that you had come across in your book research that surprised you the most about heirloom seeds. Was there anything that came to mind?
You know, the only thing that I was it made me really excited was that I found it very interesting. I've always grown heirlooms because I love the flavor. I love how different they look. Mm-hmm. They've just been great fun. But I started to figure out that people are very, very passionate about them, and they did have these family stories. And I loved hearing it, and I was surprised at how, you know, devoted they were to growing these. And it made me just have a new appreciation about the diversity and what that really means as far as genetic code, because lots of times you skip over that. You know, because you're thinking, oh, that's all scientific and stuff. But it's real basic. It's, you know, just like people and animals, and the more diversity, the better. It's just sort of a basic thing.
Right.
And it really keeps things, you know, it keeps things the best, you know, to have the diversity of everything. And I was surprised to see just how much we really needed that. So
good.
I've enjoyed learning. Yeah.
That's a good point. I tell everybody, remember that in your own gardens. Plant lots of diversity. Monocultures are not very good situations because they create environments where you're more likely to suffer from diseases and pests. So diversity is very important, as well as genetic diversity, as Chris was just mentioning. So Chris, we are so delighted you could come in, and we hope that you'll be posting lots of pictures of the beautiful heirloom vegetables that you'll be growing in your own garden. And thank you so much for joining us today. We've really enjoyed having you.
Thank you so much for having me. I love this topic, and it was great talking with you.
I can't say that my knowledge of heirlooms is very vast. So I think that in like about 15 minutes, that was a great overall background for those who are not aware of heirlooms and the importance of keeping up with the diversity. When Chris said that we have lost 90% of our diversity in seeds, I was really, really shocked. You know?
I know. It is a bit disturbing. And I think that's why it's so wonderful that we have organizations such as Seed Savers Exchange, which is a large nonprofit organization helping to keep these heirloom seeds alive and to continue to save them for future generations,
exactly.
Which will help us so much in preserving these old foods. And the more you find out about these old foods, it would be a shame to lose them, I'll tell you that.
Well, I'm really excited about growing some of these heirloom varieties from Botanical Interest, because when you guys were talking about the flavors and the colors, I mean, it truly is something that you can't find in a nursery or a grocery store. All these interesting looking edibles was so exciting to me.
Absolutely. And I think that, for example, the way that we were talking about the historical aspects of these heirlooms, One of them, here's a pepper called Hinkelhots that was cultivated by the Pennsylvania Dutch for over 150 years. And this particular pepper was used by the Pennsylvania Dutch for pickling and making pepper vinegars. And it ripens from green to red. So for those of you who like to eat those types of foods and preserve vegetables, that's a good choice for that. And then you have, for example, a bean called Painted Pony, which is a great dual-purpose bean.
Sounds so cool, Painted Pony.
I know, isn't that a cool name? It's a long green bean, when it's young, but then as it and the green bean is stringless, but then as it grows, it provides you with these dry beans that are brown and white. So they're really beautiful dry beans that you don't see in your grocery store.
Oh, wow.
So you can pick them young and get a green bean, or you can pick them as they grow older and have a dry bean for stews and soups and all those yummy dishes, you know?
Yeah, that would probably be me. I would forget to harvest it. So it's great that as it stays on the vine longer, that I still have a use for them.
Exactly. But for those who have a short growing season, they still don't get gypped. They get the green beans.
There you
so
go.
That's nice.
Yeah, so what are some of the plants that or the vegetables that you're going to be growing this year?
Well, you know, I always buy way too many seeds, as many people do. But I'm going to be growing some new kinds of beans. You know, for example, I talked about the dragon's tongue spotted bean with Chris and the purple potted bean, which is purple and then it blanches to green. But this year I'm going to be growing besides painted pony, which I just told you about because I haven't done that yet to grow a dual purpose bean. I'm also going to be growing a bean called a red swan bean.
Ooh.
Yeah, it's really pretty. It's like a rosy pink bean. So that'll be pretty. And then I have this a bean called a runner bean sunset, which has a really pretty peachy flower. And so that'll provide me with more green beans as well. So and off the topic of beans, I'm growing some cool squashes. For example, I'll be growing a squash called Lebanese White Bush Marrow Squash.
Oh my goodness.
Because I know. And one of the reasons I'm growing squash is because I need to put a different type of family in a gardening bed for crop rotation, which I know we're going to talk about later.
That's right. That's really important.
Absolutely. And I'm growing this very cool corn called blue jade corn, which is one of the few corns that you can grow in a container. And it provides you with little blue ears of corn. And the plant grows about 2 to 3 feet tall. So I thought that would be kind of fun to put in a container, too, so I could
Ooh.
Give it a rest.
Yeah, because that sounds great for a small, like, you know, people who have small spaces and they want to grow corn.
Exactly. And I'm, of course, growing some arugula and lettuces. I have a whole bunch of lettuces coming. And one of my favorite lettuces, everybody, is a lettuce called Forellenschluss, which is a spotted romaine. It's green with like a reddish spot on the leaf.
Ooh, I love that.
It really holds up well to salad dressings. It doesn't get all limp and wimpy. And it's such a pretty lettuce. In fact, you can see it in the grocery gardening book, a bed of the lettuces that I grew last year, to give you an idea.
Ooh, I'll have to check that out.
Yeah, just a lovely, lovely lettuce. And I'm growing arugula. Are you growing arugula this
year? I am growing arugula, yeah. Mine is the Rocket Salad Roquette, which is an organically certified and heirloom variety from Botanical Interest. And what's really cool, that is actually going to be one of the main ingredients of an appetizer I am serving tonight. So I think next podcast we'll talk about, you know, how the appetizers actually taste, because I've never made this before. But arugula is something that I'm going to be growing, as well as the radish cherry bell, which is organic certified and an heirloom variety as well. And once again, another main ingredient that I will be growing in my garden. And I'm making two appetizers tonight. Radish dip made with just garlic, radishes, and cream cheese. So simple, so simple, Teresa, but it is really super tasty. It's a nice dip to make other than ranch.
Okay. I'm so glad you're doing that because, you know, I'm growing all these different types of radishes and I'm always looking for recipes. So I think that's going to be a great idea.
I will post those recipes as soon as I get some feedback from the people tonight. And then another couple that I'm going to be growing is the lettuce butterhead Tom Thumb. I love the idea. It's an heirloom variety, once again, but I love the idea that the lettuce head itself is just like the perfect size for a little individual salad.
Great.
I just thought that sounded so cute and great for people with small spaces like myself. And then I don't normally grow tomatoes from seed just because we have such a short growing season. So I normally grow the biggest plant in the nursery to give me a head start, you know.
Right.
This tomato bush green zebra. It's not
organic,
and it's not an heirloom, but it's just the idea of growing a green zebra tomato I thought was just so cool. I'm going to have to try it.
It's a really good tomato. I think you'll like it a lot.
Awesome.
It's an attractive one, too.
Good.
Well, that
so, yeah,
sounds...
you were talking about crop rotation. And not that we're going to get a whole lot into it right now, but basically every season or every 1 to 2 years, you definitely want to change out the type of crop you are growing in that one particular spot to eliminate disease and pest problems that can be specific to that vegetable family. And Teresa, you were going to share some vegetable families that you may want to change out. You know, maybe you grew tomatoes there or potatoes last year. What would you want to place in the garden this year?
I can tell you folks that Jamie's absolutely right. Any farm advisor or any horticultural expert would say to you that you want to avoid growing vegetables from the same family in the same spot year after year. So you need to rotate. That's one of the reasons I'm growing squash, because I haven't grown anything from the squash family in that particular raised bed. But I have been growing things from the same family that tomatoes come from, because I love tomatoes and I love peppers and I love eggplants. And unfortunately, they all belong to the same family, as do potatoes, believe it or not. So if you've grew tomatoes or potatoes or peppers or eggplants in a particular area in your garden, then you don't want to grow those same things in that spot again. If you're growing, for example, pumpkins or summer squash or winter squash, then you want to avoid growing watermelons and cantaloupes and melons in that spot, because they're from the same family. Also, Jamie mentioned radishes. Well, believe it or not, radishes are from the same family as rutabagas and turnips, not necessarily the most popular vegetables, although they're very healthy and tasty. But they also are in the same family as the popular broccoli, Brussels sprouts, cabbages, cauliflower, kale, and mustard greens. So you see, folks, it really pays to kind of do a little research on those family groups, because that'll help you to rotate your crops annually, and you'll really not only help to prevent diseases and pests, but you'll also add valuable nutrients to your soil as well.
That is great information, and I think is going to be super helpful for everybody, Teresa. So you're going to have some information linked either on the podcast page or linked to your seasonal wisdom blog. And then not only that, but we have just added a new handbook. It's called Grow Your Own Food by C. Forrest McDowell. It's a really, really popular handbook with, it's not a Bible or anything. It's like 68 pages, super easy to follow. It's got nutritional information. So that I will also have a link to the AHA Modern Living website if people are interested in buying that handbook. It's really popular. It's sold over about a million copies so far.
And Grocery Gardening has not sold a million copies yet, folks, because it's only been out about a month. But there's plenty of growing information for 20 different types of fruits and vegetables.
That's right.
But enough shameless promotion. Anyway, that's why, you know, if you probably are like me and have a million questions about what you want to do in your garden that extend far beyond seeds and hybrids and heirlooms. And that's why, as Jamie said, we're just delighted to have Rebecca Sweet here with us, because she's going to give us a lot of good tips that we should ask ourselves before we go to those nurseries and spend a lot of money. So it's that time again when everybody starts to think about their garden and what they want to plan for this year. And I'll tell you, I had a lot of questions myself. That's why I have called in the experts. And today I'm pleased to be able to speak with Rebecca Sweet, who is a landscape designer in California and has a company called Harmony in the Garden. And Rebecca's gardens have been featured in fine gardening magazines, and she just has a ton of great tips to give us. So we're so glad to have you here today, Rebecca.
Well, thank you. I'm so glad to be here.
Well, as you can imagine, Rebecca, a lot of people are probably thinking, what should they do with their garden? Of course, they're doing their spring cleaning and so on, but what are some of the questions that people should ask themselves before they start planting their garden this spring?
Well, it's perfect timing that you ask me this, because my phone is starting to ring again from people asking the same question. And as spring approaches, they start wondering how they get started. And I always ask them primarily, what's your goal? What is it you want to do? Is it instant gratification, which I think lots of times it is? People are coming out of the winter doldrums.
and all they want is to have some color and fragrance in their lives. But lots of times they might be wanting to take on a larger project, you know, maybe want to redo a couple of beds, things that didn't quite work out or survive the winter, or maybe it's a long-term project where they want to put in a patio or arbor or a barbecue, in which case it's a great time to start calling those contractors and getting on their schedule. So the first thing I say is, what's your goal? What do you want to accomplish?
You know, as a designer, do you have any tips for those of us who are a little design challenged in terms of selecting colors or repeating patterns or any general tips that you could give people for laying out their garden in an attractive way?
You know, yeah, there's definitely some, you know, quote unquote rules, which I use the term really loosely. For example, you know, a lot of magazines and a lot of people will say, you know, you want to plant in odd numbers, not even numbers. It just tends to look a little more natural,
mm-hmm.
So, which I do. I follow, but not, I don't follow it all the time. Sometimes it is okay just to plant two of something, mm-hmm. instead of five of something. I would say things tend to look better grouped in more than one, you know, so maybe have three of something or seven of something, again, using the odd numbers. It just makes more of an impact. When I first started gardening, and I think a lot of beginning gardeners do this, I think it's really common, you just buy one of each plant.
Right.
And, you know, that's fine. If you just love collecting plants, that's great, but it can lead to a somewhat chaotic look. And at some point, as you progress, you're going to say, what's the problem here? I don't like my garden. And that's probably the reason. So that's when you can start taking some of the plants out and repeating patterns or plants. I don't always repeat the same plants. Something that I find is really effective, if, for example, if you want to repeat a color, use different plants but that have the same color.
Okay.
You might use, let's say you want to do burgundy. You could use a loripetalum. And mm-hmm. then you could use a barberry or a dark burgundy heuchera. So it's not so matchy-matchy. You know, we have a little rhythm here in our garden, and everything matches. You have repetition of color, but different plants, and that's what makes a garden really interesting.
I do tend to prefer to have to organize by color rather than to have too much of the same thing, probably because I'm one of those that would prefer to buy one of every single plant.
Yeah, right. You know, and everybody's different. And some people want a very limited color palette, you know, three colors only or one color only. Mm-hmm. Some people want it really, really bright and festive. So, you know, I really always try and find out from each person what it is that they want, and not to be intimidated. If you like all orange, then have an all orange garden. You know, don't be intimidated and let other people tell you that doesn't look good. You know, but you know, don't just do orange marigolds. Maybe you can do a whole bunch of different really neat orange plants. So just find out what you like and feel comfortable and do it.
That's great. Speaking of color, if you have a garden center further away that you're looking at from a further distance, what do you recommend in terms of color for having the most impact? For example, I made a mistake of having too many blues and purples in a bed that were kind of not as noticeable from a far distance because of the color.
Because they were so similar.
Exactly. And they were so light. And so do you have any thoughts about how to use color for the most impact?
Actually, I do. I love the color burgundy. For example, burgundy, I used that in the last example. But I think it's a great color because it actually leads the eye.
Mm-hmm.
And I wish I had a photograph to show you. But, you know, burgundy can be used to direct the eye. So if you do have a way down the line, some purple like you were talking about, you want to have something to draw your eye to it. And another color that does that is silver, mm-hmm. like silver foliage. And those two colors, burgundy or silver, are also really good at separating the blues from the purple. You know, you might use a yellow, something like that, a brighter color, or a white, something very different that kind of separates the two colors. Otherwise, from a distance, they will absolutely start to blend together. It can look good because then you get that you know, if you didn't separate it, you'd get a big mass quantity of one color, which can really make a nice impact. But, you know, if you're wanting to see the different shades, you're not going to see them so much like you experienced.
So when people are planning and they get started on a project, what are some of the biggest mistakes, but what are some of the biggest things that people tend to do that they later wish they hadn't?
I would say the biggest mistake in terms of spring planning is going berserk in the nurseries. And it's I do it too. You know, you just can't wait. Spring is finally here, and you get to the nursery, and it's just row after row of these candy-colored flowers. And, you know, you kind of lose all common sense. It's like a feeding frenzy. People just, I was at the nursery this morning, and it was just a madhouse. And what happens is you end up buying things you don't really need, and you don't have a spot for them. So to prevent that, what I do is I take pictures, the sections of my garden that need a little love. And, you know, I'll print out maybe 4 pictures per page, and I have my little piece of paper with me. And I cruise the nursery, and I just see what's available first. And then I just start walking along and finding the plants that will fit that spot. And I tell you, you can really prevent a lot of unnecessary purchases doing that. It really keeps you focused.
That's a great idea to take pictures. And you mentioned making sure that the plant fit into the spot. That's probably another big challenge, isn't it, that people kind of forget about how big that plant will eventually grow?
I call it size denial. And I too, suffer from that. You know, you see the perfect little shrub, and you love it. And it's just this nice little 2x2 shape. But the tag says it's going to be 6x6. and you think, oh, it's going to be 6x6 in other people's yard, not my yard. And then you end up trimming it and shearing it, and it doesn't look right, and it's just not going to be happy. So, you know, I'd say the second mistake people make is they don't read the plant tags thoroughly, and they don't believe the plant tags. So pay attention to the size. And then the second important thing on those plant tags, it's the lighting requirements. So what a lot of people don't realize is, you know, they print those tags like one size fits all, you know, from California to New York. So when it says sold apart sun, that's supposed to cover all of the states. You have to think about where you live, and out here in California, and if you go inland in the valley, it's so hot, and we don't get any summer rain. So when it says part to full sun, you need to put it in part sun, you know. And if you're back east where you get the nice supplemental winter or summer rains, you can put it in full sun there. So just remember that where you live. Is it hot? Do you get water?
The basics.
Yeah, the basics.
Sometimes people forget also that, you know, that they'll forget what full sun actually means.
Yeah, full sun. That's a tough one out here because, like I said about the summer water, which we don't get also, you know, are you near a stucco wall or a really hot paver driveway? That's going to just increase the full sun. And, you know, not many plants really want that true full sun, no water environment. I just came from Las Vegas, and even out there in the desert, that's full sun, no water environment. So there's not a whole lot that likes that.
It helps in California that you have that nice clay soil that retains the water so well.
Oh, okay. Now, I think you're the only person who's ever said nice and clay soil in the same sentence.
I know. I shouldn't say that.
Yeah, it kills us out here, that clay soil. It is good. It does retain the water. Kind of an understatement. Because it's pretty tough. You know, we have a lot of clay soil, and we need to amend it a lot. And that's another mistake people make is let's say they have a $1,000 budget. $900 goes towards the plants.
Good
and $100 goes towards soil and irrigation. And And you know, those two things are probably the most unsexy part of gardening is the irrigation and the soil. But gosh, they're so important.
Oh, they really are.
And you've got to really amend that soil and hook it up to irrigation if you want your garden to survive.
And smart irrigation, too. We're actually going to be covering that in a later podcast episode about saving water in the garden. But that's certainly what people should be thinking about is more effective ways to water.
Absolutely. I just kind of see people tune out when they come to me with these questions because what they want to hear first is, okay, this is the colors we're going to do, and this is the fun stuff, and they don't want to talk about irrigation.
Oh,
you know, I see their eyes glaze over. But it's so important, and just kind of bite the bullet and go with the smart irrigation. It's so important, especially out here where water is just so precious. And your garden will just thrive. Then we'll talk about colors.
And then what are you recommending that people plant this year? I know edibles are particularly hot, and mixing edibles with ornamentals is a very important trend. But are you seeing other gardening trends this year that you're recommending people adopt?
You know, I don't know if it's a gardening trend, but what I do is I really, really emphasize evergreens.
Mm.
And there's just, you know, they're so important. They're the bones of the garden. And right now, you know, so much of the country is still in winter. And now is a great time to look at your garden and see what's your structure. Do you have any structure at all? Or is it all just a deciduous or, you know, perennial garden? And there's so much you can do with foliage. So evergreens, you know, gosh, let's say euonymus, for example. There's just hundreds of varieties of euonymus.
Mm-hmm.
Gold foliage, variegated foliage, tall, small, you name it. So I like to plant a lot of those. My designs are real heavy in the evergreens. And then you bring in the showgirls, the flowers, you know, the stars of the spring and summer. But I do that, and then I like to plant a lot of plants that have more than one season's worth of interest.
Mm.
And I really see that becoming more and more of a trend with people, especially just coming out of this recession. People are really cost conscious. And so, you know, why buy one plant where it's just going to be a one-hit wonder when you can really do a little research, get a plant that has, you know, three seasons worth of interest. You know, you might get flowers as well as fall foliage, things like that. So those are probably the two trends that I consistently encourage people to follow.
Well, those are really good trends, and I'm very guilty about that. I tend to be the one who focuses too much on the flowers and not enough on the foliage. And once those flowers are gone, you really do lose a lot of the structure in your garden. So that's a really great idea. And there certainly is a lot of information that people can gather ahead of time before purchasing plants on what the foliage will look like in the fall and whether or not it keeps its shape throughout the winter. Those things certainly matter, and we do tend to forget. I know I'm definitely guilty about that. Well, this has all been really helpful, Rebecca. Is there anything else that you would recommend people consider this year before they hit the stores?
I would just say spend a little time and do a little planning. Don't walk into the nurseries kind of clueless. You know, arm yourself with some knowledge because, you know, I love nurseries. They're fabulous, but they're there to sell. And, you know, they're not always going to be providing the, you know, specific plants that are going to grow in your area. So
mm-hmm.
if you go in with some base knowledge, you can ask the right questions. If you have pictures, nurseries love pictures. If you show them a spot in your bed and you're like, you know what, this flower bed is just not doing well, what do you recommend? They can give you such intelligent recommendations. So, I just say arm yourself with a little bit of knowledge.
Those are great ideas. I'm certainly going to take a picture of that bed I've been trying to rework. I think that'll really help out a lot. Thank you very much, Rebecca.
Well, you're so welcome.
It's been a pleasure having you on, and I did want to let people know that you can follow Rebecca on Twitter. Her Twitter name is Sweet Rebecca, and those of us who do follow Rebecca know that that name is very appropriate for her because she's very sweet and she has lots of good landscape tips that she gives on Twitter. And we're just delighted you could come on today, Rebecca, and thank you very much for all your great advice.
Well, thank you so much. It's been delightful.
Can I just say that all that advice from Rebecca has already saved me money at the nursery?
Well, I wish we would have done this podcast 2 years ago, because 2 years ago it would have saved me a lot of money. But yes, those are things that you don't think about until you've made the mistake. So listening to Rebecca talk about irrigation and using evergreens to create that structure, I mean, that's something who's not a designer, you know, by nature. Those are things we don't think about until winter comes around. You're like, whoa, what happened to my garden?
That is so true. In fact, I'm going to be doing a post about the winter interest, because I find myself going to the nursery now and looking at plants that are dormant now to see if I like the way that they look now before I put them in my garden. Because I'm one of those people that Rebecca mentioned that always went for the flowers. And I always wanted all the flowers to bloom, and they would beautifully, and I'd time it all out. And then in December, it would look like death in the garden. So having those grasses and shrubs, you know, and the berries, they just make such a difference in those winter months, don't you think?
Oh, I absolutely think so. And what I also thought was interesting, when you were saying your, you know, your favorite flowers were like the blues and the purples, and then you couldn't quite figure out, like, it's just not capturing something, you know, her attention. In her thought of bringing more bold and warm colors into the landscape, it's such a simple idea that many people don't think about. So great interview, Teresa.
I thank you very much. I agree. She had some great ideas, and I'm with you on that. I'm already looking at how I can bring more color into my garden and also more structure and shape.
Awesome. And, you know, not to rub it in, but I am one of those people that actually gets to go and visit Rebecca Sweet's home for the tweet up in San Francisco. So I will be sure to mention your name and you know, pretend it as if you were there. Okay. And I'll take lots of pictures.
Thank you. And I'll give everybody a hug there too. I wish I was going to be with you for sure.
All right. Once again, we have covered a number of different helpful resources to our listeners. So no worries. We will have all that information, from Nan's seed video, Teresa's post on what she's growing, information on crop rotation, as well as a link to that Grow Your Own Food handbook that I was talking to you guys about. Not only that, we have another awesome, awesome podcast coming up next here in the near future with Susan Cohen, who is a New York-based landscape designer, as well as Teresa.
Not me. You were really
Teresa Sawitz. Christina Sawitz.
Christina Sawitz, yeah.
From Seattle. She is a personal gardening coach. And between the two interviews, we'll talk about the differences between them and when you would hire a gardening coach and when would you hire a landscape designer. And I think another thing you're going to find interesting is the different perspective that Susan Cohen has compared to the interview that Teresa had with Rebecca Sweet. So I think that's pretty awesome as well.
And I think also your interview with Christina, where she explains what a gardening coach is and how you can benefit from those services, is great. Plus, we look at whether or not you might want to have a feng shui consultant come over and look at your garden. Because just as feng shui is helping people to create a more positive life for themselves in-house, you may want to apply that same approach to your gardens as well. And that's why we're going to have Linda Binns of Boise, Idaho, who has been practicing feng shui for over 10 years, and who is an author, speaker, and TV radio personality as well.
What a lineup we have.
I'm telling you. Right. There's
Stay
a lot too. Of reasons to turn in, right?
All right. Well, hey, everybody, thanks again for joining us for another awesome Nest in Style podcast. Ta-ta for now. And in the meantime, go grow something.